So I love approaching, you know, that really heavy invitation about we, like, how do we succeed together? Because if that person does succeed at that task or removes that pattern and changes and becomes a better person and another better version of themselves, we all are successful in that. And so I never want people to feel like they're on an island by themselves and, you know, they're not, you know, they can only come off the island when they've solved this problem. It's like, no, we'll go there together. We'll work on it together. We'll come off the island together.
Hello and welcome to season 11 of the Ben Morton Leadership Podcast. It's the weekly show that brings you inspiring interviews with managing directors, CEOs, and global thought leaders, all designed to help you be the very best leader you can possibly be. It's my gift to you, and it's absolutely free. In today's episode, we are chatting with Jared Lopicolo. He is the CEO and founder of Noble Studios, a leading digital performance marketing agency. With over two decades of experience, Jared has led Noble Studios to success around the globe, partnering with top brands like Adobe, Disney, Visa, and Google. In this episode, some of the things we are going to discuss and that you can learn about is how to let go of tasks and master the art of delegation. We're talking about the importance of personal branding, especially in the digital age, and how we can successfully and intentionally manage our reputation. We're also talking about work-life balance, defining what that means for you and some of the tactics and approaches you can then use to strike the balance that is right for you. And we're also looking at some of the key elements and components that sit behind the amazing culture that exists at Noble Studios and some of the things they've done to enable them to win numerous rewards around being a great place to work and a great company to work for. And if you enjoy this episode, when you're done, do also check out episode 143. And I've popped a link in the show notes for you, because in that episode, you've got a lot more from me talking about delegation, tips, tactics, and approaches. That's enough by way of an introduction, though. So let's dive right in to this week's episode. Jared, a very warm welcome to the show. It's great to have you with us. And can I kick straight off and ask you, can you tell us about your first memorable leadership experience, good or bad, and how that has gone on to shape you as a leader?
Yeah, thank you, Ben. I think a lot of leaders struggle with this concept, whether you're an entrepreneur or a leader, is this concept around delegation. And it was probably 5 years into our 20-year journey where, you know, you can imagine it's a Friday night. We have a deadline, which, by the way, never set deadlines for Friday nights. That was something I've learned out of this. But Friday night at 5 o'clock, we have a deadline for a massive client. Their name is Autodesk. They're a Fortune 500. It was me plus like six other team members. And my wife and partner shows up at the office with our two kids, 5 and 2. And she's like, okay, we're going to go down now to the tree lighting ceremony. And this was December 5th at 5 p.m. And it's where Santa kind of comes down the main drag. And as he's coming down, the lights turn on. And then it ends at the main Capitol. And then there's a tree lighting ceremony. And there's, you know, choir. And it's just this wonderful, like, traditional experience. And she comes up and I just said, I'm not going to be able to make it. We're not hitting this deadline. And she just didn't even say a word. She just turned around, walked out with the kids. And I knew then I was in trouble. I was like, oh, I'm in trouble. And then it was like, took about 5 minutes of silence. And our team members just looked over. They looked at me and said, Jared, what are you doing? Like, we got this. Don't worry. Like, just go. It's going to be okay. Like, we know how to take this, you know, to the finish line. And I just gave up. I just said, okay, I just surrendered, if you will, to that moment. And that was this idea, like, as a leader and an entrepreneur, to sort of let go. And that's the only way to really truly grow, is to sort of let go. And I realized in that moment, I needed a framework to feel confident that I could let go. And so there's many of them out there. This one is it's like focused on risk and delegation. And it's really looks at the talent and the talent, where are they at in terms of a scale of their readiness? And then you look at the importance of a task and you say, okay, is it so if it's really, really important task and their readiness is low, well, then you need to really kind of prescribe what an outcome looks like. And you got to stay close to that deliverable. But if their readiness is super high and the importance is low, or even the importance is high, but their readiness is there, then you can truly delegate and walk away and maybe only just be informed. So lucky to say I made the tree lighting ceremony. It worked out. Happy family, happy wife. And at the same time, that learning lesson of being able to delegate. And by doing so, it really allowed me to focus on the things that only I could do and allow the team members to own the things that they could do over and over again and repeatedly be consistent with those tasks. And ultimately, they're going to do a better job, you know, than me over time because they own it 100% as opposed to me only owning it, say, 30% of the time. So that was it. I would say it was really this delegation transformation moment of time. And that's really just served us and allowed us to grow and let go of things and take on new, more important things that nobody else could do.
I love that. And it's almost in my mind, I'm picturing sort of two graphic equalizer dials on a stereo. So one was readiness. What was the first one again? Was it sort of impact of the task?
Yeah, sort of like importance of the task, right? Importance of the task or object or goal, and then the team member's readiness. Those are the two levers.
So in terms of the readiness one, what did that look like in practice as you started playing around with that framework? Was it more of like a formal process you went through where you looked at all of the team and thought about their readiness? Or is it much more in the moment as you're delegating a task, then you're thinking about the person's skill and competence, or a combination of both?
I was just going to say, it's a bit of a combination of both. It was sort of, you know, first doing that initial assessment of where do they sit? You know, are they a senior in your organization? Or, you know, what I talk about is experience, right? How much experience do they have with that very specific task or objective? And if they've got a lot of experience in it, then therefore their readiness is likely pretty high. If they are a senior, but they've never even approached a task like this, then their readiness for that specific task or objective is actually low. And therefore you want to kind of partner with them at that moment in time. But then once they get that same similar task, now their readiness is a little higher because they've gained effectively more experience.
Got you. And what was it for you, Jared, in those early days that was preventing you from delegating? Because I think this is a really fascinating subject, and it is one that so many leaders at all levels struggle with. And over the last 6 months, I've been looking at some of the research around sort of the state of delegation in the workplace, and the stats are shocking. Like, about only a third of leaders and managers believe they've got the skills to delegate effectively. Only about a third of people on the receiving end believe their boss delegates in an effective way. I mean, there's something like 75% of organizations don't have confidence in their manager's ability to delegate. And I mean, there's often a number of common things that prevent people from letting go and delegating. So what was it for you? Do you remember particularly?
You know, I think it comes down to your personal brand, right? And as a leader or entrepreneur, you know, at the end of the day, I always say, like, okay, if everything goes really, really well, I'm going to give credit to everybody else. But if everything goes really, really bad, I have to take all the blame for that because I'm not preparing the team enough, or I didn't foresee maybe these obstacles that maybe existed that, you know, I overlooked. And so I think there's two things. One is, it's your personal brand, and that's why you're worried to delegate, because you're like, if I delegate it and it doesn't go well, that's on me. And then I think the second piece is actually being patient and taking your time to set that person up for success. So, you know, when you think about context setting, right, it's like, look, I'm going to explain why this task is really, really important, because they might not see the level of importance, right? As a leader or an entrepreneur, you're constantly looking at 5 different factors, 20 different factors as to what makes that important. It might be that, hey, the task is really low importance in terms of execution, but if we don't do it right, the impact is so much greater because it might mean more business, it might mean more, you know, whatever. And so I think those two things are constantly sort of in tension, you know, have tension between each other, is, you know, my own personal brand and letting go if something goes wrong, and then being actually available for that individual and set the context and walk them to what a finish line looks like, you know, or what is paint done, as Brené Brown says, looks like.
Yeah. I want to talk more about the brand piece shortly, but I think the setting them up for success piece is so important. I don't know what your take on this, but I often think for a good number of people, when it comes to delegation, the challenge isn't so much around having the confidence or skills to delegate effectively. It's more of a time management challenge in that as leaders, as the delegator, we're not scanning far enough ahead, thinking about what needs to come up and being able to delegate it. So you give someone enough runway to develop the skills, to deliver it, for you to be there to check in and support them. So we end up delegating last minute, and then we're surprised when things don't go according to plan, right?
Yep, that's exactly, you know, and that's the point. It's like, how do you really set up them, to your point, for success? Like, what does that end result, what does 100% look like? And not to wait till you're finally at, you know, you no longer can take this on because you're just so spread thin and you decide that's the time to delegate. It's better when you have all the time in the world to actually do the task yourself. That's the moment to delegate. And I think a lot of us get caught into the, well, it's just faster if I do it myself. And I know the outcome, it's going to be perfect. You're right. You know, doing it yourself, you're going to be able to control the quality and you're going to be able to do it in like a quarter of the amount of time. But if you're playing the long game, right, and you really want to grow this person into their best version of themselves and set them up for success and allow you to let go of those things, you've really got to invest in at the beginning to do that. And it's going to take some time, but then eventually you realize I no longer have to do that. And it's now you get a new problem or a new obstacle or a new opportunity to focus on.
Yeah, absolutely. Love that. Quick one for you. If this part of the podcast is really resonating with you, and if delegation is a skill that you want to get better at as a leader or manager, then check out my Delegation Mastery course via the link in the show notes. It's an on-demand online program that is helping hundreds of leaders to finally master this key skill. And as you're a member of my community here on the podcast, you can get 30% off of the course, taking it down to just $19.99 with code POD30. That's POD30. Back to the episode. I want to talk about brand as well and personal brand. And it's interesting in that I think for many leaders working in the corporate world, there are sort of three things that can often make some people want to be sick in their mouth. One is the idea of doing a degree of self-promotion. I think another one is sort of the idea of politics in an organization, which is something I was chatting to Michael Watkins about recently on the podcast. And the other one is brand. But I think all of those things, we have to spend some time and attention on them as leaders if we want to be successful, right? And it would be nice to say, well, I'll just let my results speak for themselves or my actions can speak for themselves. But I don't think that's always the best strategy. So as someone who's built a really successful brand and agency, let's start, if you don't mind. What does brand mean to you? Because the definition is always a good starting point, right?
Yeah, it is. And to your point, there's a lot of ways to interpret what does brand mean. I think at the highest level, I guess, just riffing for a second, I feel like brand is about, it's really a living story and it's made up, right? It's sort of made up of all the, if it's a personal brand or an agent, let's say it's an agency brand, it's made up of the agency's identity, its core values, its promise to all of the stakeholders, whether that's, you know, team members, clients, partners. When you have a brand strong enough, it helps create a distinction, you know, between you and your competitors. But I don't think that marker of distinction is all that it is. It's also, it helps guide your culture. It influences your behavior. It allows to set targets for the growth that maybe you're going after, or, you know, what partners you do want to partner with. When I think about any brand, whether it's a personal brand or a company brand, it you know, and ours in particular, was built really around sort of rigorous processes and disciplines about the truth of what our deeply held beliefs are, you know, and how much we infuse our passion into sort of every experience and every touch point. And so I guess one could say that our brand is essentially an essence of who we are.
So for you, then, it sounds like your brand is really strongly based in your core values and beliefs. It's just the embodiment of those, right?
Yes, exactly. And those get obviously developed over time, you know, based on saying yes to so many things and then start to dial back and say no to things and, you know, having good clients and bad clients and good team members and bad team members. So all of that gets built over time into, you know, an effective brand and how you want to show up in the world and how you want people to experience your brand and what what expectations they have coming to your company because they've read about you or they were referred to you. And your job is really to fulfill on that brand promise that people are expecting from you.
Yeah. So what are then some of the practical things that you've done in the business that perhaps those listening could take and apply in terms of, I guess, building and then maintaining their brand?
Yeah. Again, back to whether it's a personal, and it's funny because people's personal brands are quite attached to the company brands and they're often made up of that. But I would say that if you're building your own personal brand or a company brand, I think it's probably rooted in a few things. One, I think in maybe it's overstated these days, but it's really around authenticity. But I think it's being true to your core principles that you've developed for your personal brand or your company brand. I think it's also, you know, this idea that you're going to fulfill on those promises and then you're going to be authentic about fulfilling those promises. I think about consistency. When you think of a brand, right, you really want to make sure that all touch points, you're showing up consistently with that same, you know, promise and that same value. And so that people come to expect that from you and hold you to those standards. And then I think it's really about engagement, right? Listening really, really well for feedback of how you could be better. We subscribe to Let's Be Better Every Day. It's our tagline. But that really shows your loyalty and your commitment and building community and that recognition. And so I think with those three sort of principles, they're universal, you know, authenticity, consistency, and engagement. And I think if you lead with those and you adopt those, you'll naturally build an impactful, strong, memorable brand, whether that's for you personally or for your company.
I think the consistency piece is key, right? I must have been 6 or 7 years ago now. I heard a guy called Scott Stratton. I don't know if you might have come across him actually.
Who's a, yeah, I have.
Yeah, so I heard Scott Stratton speak at a conference and he gave a really great definition of brand that he was talking about it in the business context, but since then I've grabbed it and I think it's really valuable in terms of a personal or leadership brand. But he described it as quite simply as people's most recent experience of you or your company and the most extreme. And when he was telling the story, we just so happened to be in a Ritz-Carlton hotel. So he was telling the story that many people will have heard about Joshy and the Ritz-Carlton. So Joshy was this little cuddly toy. I can see you nodding. So I'm guessing you've heard the story. So long story short, for people who've not heard it, a family go away on holiday. The son leaves his cuddly toy at the hotel. Quick thinking dad on the way to the airport tells his son that, oh, it's not forgotten. Joshy, this toy, is having a holiday. And he quickly phones the Ritz-Carlton and asks if they can find it, which they do. They don't just send it back to him. They send it back with a little photo album of pictures of Joshy by the pool, having a massage. It's amazing thing that they did, which incidentally is based on Ritz-Carlton's values around creating magical memories or something along those lines. So there you've got most extreme. And then most recent, we think, well, he said, what was all of your experience like, those of you who are staying here? But it's really relevant for leaders, right? Because the most extreme could be the day we're in a bad mood or the day we're feeling stressed and we blank someone in the corridor. Like we walk past the security guard and don't say hello. That's their most recent. And if we kind of lose it and scream and shout at anybody, that's someone's most extreme. And it can take a long time to change those. It's a neat way of thinking about it, I think.
I love it. In fact, you did a good job of sort of percolating that down. And I love the most recent and most extreme because those two, truly, if you're showing up consistently back to that on both of those occasions, then you know you have a healthy brand and you know that you're unwavering in how you're going to approach customer service and or product design or, but the end result, you're going to fulfill on that experience that that person is expecting from you. And I think about that with like Nike, right? A very well-known brand. And it's like you think about shoes are expensive. So I'm expecting them to fit really well. I'm expecting myself to feel like an athlete. When I put them on, I get this sort of dopamine release that I'm going to go for a run. And, you know, and if it doesn't fulfill on that, if all of a sudden I put these on, I paid too much, they don't feel like they're flat-soled, I don't feel like I want to get outside and exercise, it's not fulfilling on that experience that I come to expect from a big brand like Nike. So, but I love that. Yeah, most recent and most extreme. I'm gonna take that from this. Thank you.
It's not me. I took it from Scott Stratton. So credit where credit's due.
Fair enough. Yeah.
And have you ever, as an agency, made any of those tough decisions not to take on a particular client because it didn't fit with your brand or because of any concerns about how it would affect your brand? Because that's the ultimate test, right? It's easy to say this is our brand when things are going well and you've got amazing clients. But when someone's offering you maybe a lot of money to work with them, but it jars, they're the tricky calls.
And I would say every leader or entrepreneur has one of these stories that either become a defining moment for you to hold close your core values and your brand. One of them in particular for us, and anyone could relate, right? We're in this moment of time where, we're probably 7 years into our journey. Payroll is tough, right? We've got, every 2 weeks here in the US, we pay payroll. And I remember getting a call from an agency, and I don't mind saying it, it was Leo Burnett. They're a large agency in the US. They focus on McDonald's and, some of the cigarette and alcohol brands. And I got a call and they said, we have this project, for you, and it's for Marlboro cigarettes. And, you've been referred into us. There's no RFP process, but we need you to be here in Chicago, this week, if you can, because we need to kick this thing off, So, okay. So I got on a plane within days. I'm there in front of them. I'm like, wow, this is over $1 million project that they need help with in 6 months. And I just thought this is going to solve so much, right? It's going to not only pay payroll, it's going to accelerate us, allow us to invest further into new service lines and all the benefits, right? And I come back to the office and I say, we have a winner. We have this opportunity. It's bird in hand. And I had one team member said, I can't work on that. There's a conflict of interest. My father passed away from actually smoking Marlboro cigarettes. And I just can't be a part of that. And I was okay. And then went to the next team member and was like, yeah, I'll do it if we need to, but I really don't want to be a part of it. And so I had to do some soul searching, right? I was like, okay, is this the kind of, why would we take this on? And we started going through it and I thought, well, I can't talk about this brand because it doesn't align with Noble as a core value. And that's our company's name. I can't really put this on our website. It's likely not going to lead to more business that we want to have. And we've got some internal conflict that's going on. And so, made the Noble, if you will, decision to say, this doesn't align with our brand. I'm not saying it doesn't align with other people's brands or agency brand, but it didn't align with ours. And so I went back to the client and I said, look, I made a mistake. I made a mistake by going out there, taking the meeting. It's not right for us. And I'll tell you, I've never felt more shameful in my life because he made me feel so bad for wasting his time. Oh, and he said, this was a referral. I thought this was a done deal. We were ready to get started. I had teams lined up. And I felt the most guilt I've ever felt in my life, literally in for the business. And I just thought to myself, what am I doing? Da, da, da. And so I went to a friend, an agency friend. I said, look, I got to tell you the story that just happened. And they're a big agency in California. And I told him about it. And he said, well, good for you. Good for you to stick to your core values and your ethos as a company. And don't worry, opportunities always, come around. And not but 2 weeks, he knew what was going on. 2 weeks later, he phones me up and he said, hey, I didn't want to tell you the time, but we just won actually, this anti-tobacco program in California. Would you like to partner with us on that? And so instead of $1 million piece of business, it was $600,000 a year. But what the hell? Now we're doing the right stuff and everyone felt comfortable. And that same person who said, I can't work on it, became the champion of that work. And the rest is history. So yeah, it's tough. It's like, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to chase a dollar. You're going to chase. But I think play the long game. Don't play the short game. You'll always feel better when you wake up knowing you made those right decisions for the long game.
Yeah. So two questions off of that. Two things really intrigue me. Like, on the first one, when you went back and said, hey, look, I've made a mistake, this isn't for us, and the agency's response, did that, for me, that would have sort of affirmed my decision. I've gone, actually, if they're going to respond to me in that way, actually, I don't think you're the sort of agency or people I would want to work with anyway.
Yes. In fact, we oftentimes talk about, and everyone uses their own sort of filtering system. We call it red flags. And, it's quite common. Hey, did you notice any red flags? And there was a few at the very beginning that I was like, well, I'll just get past it, right? Because you have the shiny object of payroll and, new service line expansion, all these other things that are in the way. You sort of decide you don't want to look at the red flags. Maybe it's just a yellow flag, And you're like, all right, well, that's fine. We're still in the game. But no. And then when I had that call, I just thought, oh, thank goodness. Like, even though I literally tail between my legs and I felt just so shameful for doing that, it just reaffirmed that this is the right decision. Because if it wasn't going to be this moment, imagine month down the road, we had this tension, we finally took this client and we're putting our best work out there, and then that client's not happy. That would be the worst, because now we're like, wait, we're working with a client we don't want to, and we're not getting that sort of love language, that gratification that's coming from a client like that. So it just reaffirmed, to your point, like, that was the right decision.
Yeah.
I've not thought about this before, but listening to you talk there about red flags and all, maybe that's not a red flag, which is going to be human nature, right? Especially when it's your own business or you've got big targets to hit. You can easily talk yourself out and find a reason why it's not a red flag. So I was just thinking, like, in my business, I might set up some sort of system where, like, one red flag is nearly a no, but if I've got two or three yellows, then they equal a red as well, a bit like we have in soccer in the UK.
Yeah, exactly. That was where I was going, a little bit of the football analogy for the UK, because I think you're right. I think you can easily, you know, say, well, it's a red flag. Let's just get past that. It's okay. We'll fix it. And I think there are some yellow flags. I think that's where you know, requires a crucial conversation with the client to say, look, I've got some warning signs here and there's some risk. And at the end of the day, we've got to bring our best selves forward and we got to produce our best product. And in this environment, things we're seeing looks like it's not going to set us up for success. Can we talk that through first? And maybe those were yellow flags and then they're gone away because through conversation or expectation setting or whatnot. But sometimes usually if it smells bad, it means bad.
I'm sitting here nodding because like I've got that situation kind of now in my business. And even if those red flags don't sort of materialize early on, I think it's a fairly safe bet that at some stage, at some time down the road, it's going to become an issue. And it's interesting, right? I talk about this in my work a lot in terms of having difficult conversations with a team member. And I always say, like, any sort of big performance management or really tricky conversation that you suddenly have to deal with, it's often due to a small issue earlier on that you ignored or didn't deal with, right? And it's just an interesting moment of realization for me that with this particular client, I've not applied those same principles that would have an individual to an organization. Interesting.
And I think in those moments, I think the hardest thing to do is to it's the hardest thing. I talk about change sometimes. When change shows up at my front doorstep, I'm like, shit, here it is again. But then I say, oh, you know what? And I open the door and I let it in. And then we work through that change. And I think it's the same concept. Like, if you do notice something that's early, it's best just to have that conversation right off the bat, because it's like almost like, okay, we're going to go to Mars, but if we're 1 degree off when we leave Earth, it's going to mean, you know, years apart when we finally get to that distance of Mars. But if you correct it at the beginning, you won't find yourself months down the road really distant and far apart. And sometimes that's not correctable after that. But if you start to go in early days, have those crucial conversations, oh, they're hard. And I'm such a people pleaser, right? That I just don't want anybody to ever feel bad. And I always want everyone to feel good and comfortable and everything's going to be okay. And so I struggle with having those crucial conversations that every time I'm rewarded with that. Once I do it, it makes for a better relationship. It sets the expectations. There's no ambiguity. None of us are negotiating in our head on what that means. And it just makes for a better relationship. So yeah, that'd be my advice, is like early on, have those conversations. And you might find that, you know, you were just negotiating in your head, or you might find, oh my gosh, I'm so glad that was a red flag. It was just peeking out just a little bit. I didn't see it. And now all of a sudden, by talking through it, we exposed it and we neutralized it.
Yeah. So more and more, I'm starting to believe in fate or karma or some sort of higher intelligence in the universe. And what led me to say that is listening to you talk there about difficult conversations. Just last week, I was running a leadership program. One of the things we was talking about was challenging conversations. And this picture just emerged in my head that I drew out on the flip chart for the group. And just more and more, I'm thinking, yeah, that is it. So I think with challenging conversations or crucial conversations, all of us, I think, would like to feel more confident having them. How do we get confidence? Well, it's partly through developing the skill, right? How do we develop the skill to have a crucial conversation? There is no shortcut, I don't think. It's simply by having more of the conversations. Yes, there are some techniques we can use, but we still need to practice them to develop that skill. Therefore, what do you need to have the conversation before you've fully got the skill and the confidence? Courage, right? You've just got to step into it. So as someone who said, like, you've struggled with it, you're a people pleaser, what are some of the practical things that you have done to help you get over that hurdle that people listening at home who undoubtedly will have the similar sort of feelings about challenging conversations. What can they take away and use that you've learned over the years?
Yeah, I think it comes down to trying to be objective versus subjective. And I think that all of us wear emotions on our sleeve. And I encourage it. I encourage people to bring their whole selves to all interactions. But when you're going to have a crucial conversation, I think it's really important that you're objective and you don't bring so much emotion to those. And what might happen is, you know, finally having that crucial conversation might be built up of emotion because you've allowed things to sit and, oh, it's happened again. And that thing happened again. And next thing you know, they always say it's like the straw that, you know, breaks the camel's back, in meaning that it's not this big event. It's the repetitiveness of that, you know, that cropped up behavior or pattern. And so I think it's about two things. I think one, trying to really show up where it's objective. So I'm going to be very objective. I'm not going to bring emotion into this. I'm going to stay calm, cool, collected. And then I think it's about having a common end result, right? What does success effectively look like? And going in with that in mind, right? Going in and saying, you know, what success really looks like, I'm going to set this person up really well. I'm going to give them good feedback so that they can be a better human. And we're all going to work together on this end result, which is going to benefit the company. It's going to benefit myself. It's going to benefit that individual. And so those would be the two things. You would say, what does an end goal look like? Making a win-win, success for all. And then how do I show up objective and not become subjective in there? Because it's real easy to say, you know, start pointing fingers when the conversation gets heated, or if you're providing that crucial conversation and that feedback to that individual, their natural response is going to be a defense mechanism, right? It's going to be like, wait, hold on, you're not seeing the big picture, or wait, that's not really exactly what happened. And it's okay to listen and, you know, and not to drive those, you know, and not to point blame, but it's more like, well, I understand that, but did you see that you're showing up this way, or by continuing that pattern, it's affecting all these other people around you. So just really objective, non-subjectivity. And then again, aligning on what success looks like for everyone. I think if you can enter a conversation that way, I think you'll be successful. The other thing, like you said, though, it just takes practice and it's consistency. It's that experience part. You don't get it. You can get the same experience in 10 years versus 1 year, but it has to be a volume of those moments, you know? So,
yeah. And I think it's important as well that you said sort of when you was almost sort of role-playing some of those conversations, you used we a lot. I think that's key, isn't it? It's not about almost pointing the finger, here's some feedback, you need to fix it, you need to work on this, you need to change. It's more about, okay, what can we do together? How can I help you? What support do you need? So it's two of you attacking the problem rather than one of you attacking the person. I mean, that's really key, isn't it?
It is. In fact, I think about often, you know, the invitation, if you will, when someone needs to work on something, to your point, it's an invitation. I'm going to work on this with you. And we're both going to be successful, even though you might do some of the heavier lifting because it sits more in your court. But there's always two ways to tackle, you know, that sort of problem that's in front of you. And likely, it's never just on one side, right? There's always a little bit of both. So it might be that I need to change my managerial style slightly, or I might need to change how we approach, you know, tackling a specific objective, or, you know, the who starts the objective first versus who has it. But there's always, it's never going to be just like, well, it's, you know, Sarah's fault or Joey's fault, and it's all of them to work on it. There's probably some onus on both sides. So I love approaching, you know, that really heavy invitation about we, like, how do we succeed together? Because if that person does succeed at that task or removes that pattern and changes and becomes a better person and another better version of themselves, we all are successful in that. And so I never want people to feel like they're on an island by themselves. And, you know, they're not, you know, they can only come off the island when they've solved this problem. It's like, no, we'll go there together. We'll work on it together. We'll come off the island together.
Yeah. And that's a nice lead in, Jared, to something else I wanted to ask you. So we've spoke a bit about delegation and letting go in the early days of the agency. You've touched there on feedback and not wanting people to feel like an island. So what would you say are some of the other, I guess, foundational elements that you've built Noble on? Because you've won a series of awards, right, around best places to work. When I was doing my research, there's some amazing reviews on LinkedIn about what a great place it is to work and the team you've built. What are some of those other fundamentals, the bedrock that the agency sits on in terms of its people and culture?
Yeah, I think in order to build a strong culture of people that feel safe to bring their whole selves to work, right? You have to align at the very top of the company in that you have a strong vision and a strong mission, and you have a healthy leadership team that believes in that vision. And then that ultimately goes, you know, down the ranks, if you will. And I'm not a top down, you know, type of company, but I think when you want to lead with a strong vision and mission, it needs to be owned at the top and it needs to be shared at the top, you know, by all. And then once that happens, then you attract the right people. And it's the Jim Collins, get the right people on the bus, get the wrong people off the bus. But then I think, so you have this strong vision and mission, and you've got the right people now on the bus. Maybe they're not in the right seat. And so then you'll work with them to get them right in the right seat. And you'll ask them, you'll see what their passions are and, you know, where they want to go in their career development. And so I think those things happen. And then I think it goes down into the activities where your culture can contribute to building the company. And so we've created committees and councils at Noble Studios that are entire team member led. One of them in particular, we call Noble Deeds. And it's our philanthropic community extension of our services effectively for nonprofits. And so it's entirely led by employees. They can select a nonprofit and then we donate, you know, 1% of our capacity or our margins, however you want to, you know, consider it. And that is entirely led by them. They have full ownership in that. We also have a culture committee that they take full ownership on all of our Throwback Thursdays or our, you know, when we get into, when they plan our holiday gathering, they plan our summer solstice barbecue gathering where everyone comes into town. So they're really, you know, listening to the culture, you know, influencing the culture. Also, we subscribe to this no asshole clause, right? And so we don't want any assholes working for us. We don't want to work for any of them. We don't want any partners to feel like we have those that can maybe bully us or anything like that. So I think it's about surrounding yourself with the right people that share the right ethos and core values and such. And then the last thing I think, and back to feedback, for a healthy culture, you've got to listen to the culture. And so we've created what we call the Noble Pulse. And every single week we ask 7 questions, anything from like, how safe do you feel bringing up, you know, things at the company to how well are you being paid in your benefits? And, you know, do you feel overworked or not? And that data we get on a weekly basis, we then share that with the management team and we take action. And we actually are very transparent on a monthly basis to tell the team members, here's the feedback we heard this month. Here are the things that we're working towards. I think if you do all those pieces in concert, you're naturally going to have a healthy company because you've got people that care about the company. They feel like they're, you know, safe. They're able to bring their whole selves to work. And they know that if there is any problems, they can surface them and they get addressed.
So how easy or challenging has it been for you to sort of maintain the culture that you envision for the company in the early days as it's grown? Because the bigger, I guess, it's got, I suspect you're no longer involved in every single recruitment decision, are you? So that's just one example, right? So what's that journey been like for you as the founder and leader?
You know, it's hard because ultimately, as I said earlier, you know, you're the one that's going to give all the credit when everything goes well, and you're going to take all the blame when things don't go well. And so you as a leader actually have to be so bought into the vision and mission of the company that you're leading with so much passion, right? That you fully believe in it. You drink the Kool-Aid, as we say. And I think about, you know, like one of our famous leaders in the United States, Martin Luther King. He didn't say, I have a plan. He said, I have a dream, right? And that's a big distinction to get people to align to a plan or you get them aligned to a dream. And I think the plan can come after the dream, but everyone's got to align with the dream. So I think as a leader, you know, at the end of the day, you need to find what maintains your passion and your love and your drive. And, you know, sometimes it's okay to like soul search a little bit. But I think that constant investment in yourself, you know, those that are watching, you can see behind me, I have a whole bookcase. All those top books on the top are all self-help books, right? And so it's like the job's never done as a leader to continue to grow yourself, to be the best version of yourself. And I think oftentimes, like, I want to be the leader that I would want to follow. And I think by doing that, by being that, you naturally are going to grab, you know, people that have similar beliefs and system morals and values and want them to believe in the dream just as much.
Yeah, what you said there about wanting to be the leader that you would want to follow reminds me of, I think it was his Oscar acceptance speech for, I can't remember which film, but Matthew McConaughey. And I don't know if you saw it. If people haven't seen it, like, you should go and check it out on YouTube. Just Matthew McConaughey Oscar acceptance speech. And he tells this story of one of his mentors when he was very young said, "Who's your hero?" And Matthew McConaughey says, "Hey, I don't know. That's a big question. Let me go away and think about it. I'll come back to you." And he goes back to this guy and he says, "Okay, so who's your hero?" He said, "It's me in 10 years' time."
That's awesome. Yeah, I love that.
And he talks about like chasing this best version of himself. And he said 10 years later, he goes back to his mentor again. His mentor says, "So it's 10 years. Are you your hero?" He's like, "Hell no."
Yeah.
He said, "Well, who's your hero?" He said, "It's me in 10 years' time."
That's right. Yeah.
That really stuck with me. I think actually that's to your point that the sort of, I think you said Noble's built on better. Is it better tomorrow?
Yep. Better tomorrow than we were yesterday. Right. So,
yeah. I mean, it's just so powerful, right? Just chasing the best version of you whilst I think being kind to yourself on the journey.
I know. And that's the challenge, right? When you're always trying to better yourself for you and others, it's actually an egoless mission, you know, because it's for everyone. And
yeah,
but the challenge is, right, is that, you know, one, I would say I'm definitely content, but I'm not fully satisfied, right? Like there's still a thirst that needs to be worked on. And I think that's just going to keep me forever interested as a life learner, and you know, and hopefully that it just carries me deep into my late years. But yeah, I think that's the key, is to really model the behavior, you know, that you want others to model.
Yeah, I call it being positively restless.
I like that.
That's a nice segue, Jared, to the last thing I wanted to ask you about. And it's a nice circular question that brings us back to the start, really. You told that wonderful story of a few years in, Friday deadline, kind of your wife saying, "Hey, it's the switching on of the light, Santa's coming down the road." So what sort of entrepreneur are you, and which school of thought do you subscribe to? Are you the, I think I know the answer to this, right? But there's the hustle, 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 work 20 hours a day, sacrifice everything. Or I think there's now quite a positive like counterculture to that, where actually, like it can be more balanced, but balance means different things to different people. So what's your journey been there like, and what would your advice be to maintaining balance, whatever that might mean to somebody listening?
Yeah. And this is something that a lot of leaders and entrepreneurs struggle with, right? Is, you know, not filling up one cup, right? If one cup is your work cup, not just filling it, it's just overflowing, but actually there's all these different cups, and each one represents a part of your life, whether it's community or it's friends or it's personal passions or it's, you know, your time with your significant other or with your children or your bucket list. I mean, there's so many cups to fill. I only know one way, right? Because we've been doing this for 20 years. I subscribe to not believing in regrets, because I wouldn't be where I am today. They're just lessons to be learned. Some are learned earlier than others, and some, you know, you must learn later. But I think the first couple 5 years or so when you're starting a business, I was very much of the 80-hour work week, you know, test and learn. I go back to volume, right? In order to get so much experience, you need a lot of throughput. You need a lot of volume to come down that line, if you will. And so I think about saying yes to sort of everything at the beginning in order to know when to say no. It's so hard to say no, because you're like, well, I don't know. I haven't tried a client like that, or I haven't tried a service like that, or I haven't tried, you know, doing this particular way. But you've got to find, at some point, you've got to find that balance, because you can only do that so long. You can only say yes to and fill the one cup for so long until you start to feel this void in all these other cups. And so to your point, that tree lighting ceremony was a trigger for me to say, hey, you're not filling up the other cup here, which is family and your most immediate family, not just extended and or friends. And you're going to have to find your triggers to like help you. And so, you know, those that are watching, I've got bracelets on. And one of the main ones that I put on, which was 15 years ago, was one that said family first, right? And it was about me making that distinction of like, I can have another cup and I can give that cup just as much attention. And, you know, now I've got all these different passions, and I'm actually living three lives in one, because I've got the energy still. I guess what I would say is, you know, bring your full self to any interaction you have, put a ton of time into it, but then also know when it's not serving you, and know when you're actually like taking away from your other cups. And you're going to have to find what those trigger mechanisms are to keep you balanced, to make sure you're filling up those other parts of your life. And whether it's a bracelet first, or I have a recurring appointment in my calendar today, and it's on Sundays, and I leave it there as a reminder. I don't work Saturdays and Sundays very often anymore as an entrepreneur, very rare now, but it was a point where I put this recurring appointment that said family day in at on Sundays. And it's probably the longest recurring appointment I have. And it still shows up in my calendar today. And it's not that I need that reminder anymore, but it is a nice reminder to say that was a turning point in my career where I put a line in the sand and said, no, I can do both. And then now I've got friends, and I just got on a great photographer's trip 2 weekends ago. And now I've got all these different cups that are in concert with each other. But yeah, my advice would be, if you're going to start a business, you're going to be a leader, really lean into it just enough to get that volume, to get that experience, to then start to know the landscape, because time's one of our only currencies. And if you don't put the time in at the beginning, you might waste a lot of time later down the road because you only decided you wanted to work 32-hour work weeks. Well, it's probably going to take you a long time then to realize if that's going to work for you or not. It's a debate, right? We do now support the work-life balance lifestyle, but will you truly know what a fair weather and or bad weather sailor will be like if you only sail in the bay? Put your neck out there, but not to where it's going to cost you everything.
Yeah, that's lovely. And I just had one of those moments where you suddenly hear the same thing you've probably heard hundreds of times before, but you suddenly hear it on a slightly different level. That piece you said around trying to bring your full self to every interaction. I think actually, if for anybody listening, I really encourage you to do this, because I just had a real moment where if you really pause and think about what that statement means, almost really reflect or meditate just on that one line and think, am I doing that with my interactions with work? Is the obvious one. Yeah, we probably, most of us will tick that, but time at home with kids, if you're blessed to have them, are you really showing up as your best self for those moments? Or are you slightly distracted, slightly grumpy because of a bad day at work, or with your other half, or with your parents? Are you really showing up with your best self? That's quite powerful if you actually really do pause and do some soul searching around that, right?
Yeah, I've got a friend. He really is my anchor. He like brings me down to earth, but he's slower than I am, right? And so I have to like slow myself down, and I've got to be 100% in that conversation. And he makes me a better person because of it, and we have a better relationship because of it. And there is, just think of every moment, like at dinner. A lot of us aren't sitting down at dinner tables anymore. We're standing around the counter, we're eating. It's like, but don't have your phone out, right? Put your phone away, There's just little simple moments. Or if you're with a loved one or a family member you haven't seen in a long time, ask more questions than talk, right? Really be there, bring that whole self, be 100% there, because you might not have that moment again. And you want to be able to say like, gosh, I wish I was really listening. I can't remember what they said. That was the last time I was with that person or whatnot. And so just, yeah, bring your whole self. You'll find that it's rewarding both for the person on the other side or the experience you're having and for yourself. You'll walk away feeling more fulfilled.
Jared, I've started closing out every single episode of the show with the exact same question, which is a twist on a common one. So the question is, what would you say is the best mistake you've ever made? So something that seemed like a disaster, but turned out to be very fortuitous.
I don't know if they have a very specific example, but I encourage people to make mistakes, because that's where we learn the most, right? We don't learn when everything goes well. You just sort of like, oh, that worked out, that went well. It's when you pitch for a piece of business and you lose that business. It's when you hire someone that doesn't turn out because, you knew there was some red flag there, and then they did turn out to be, not so nice to your other coworkers. Or, you bought an object for the company because you knew it was going to move you forward, but it didn't actually do that. And so I look at every one of any of those mistakes as just those moments to learn. And when it becomes a true mistake is when you've done it multiple times in a row. And that's when you're not learning. And so I would just say, yeah, there's a lot of mistakes. Us taking that meeting in Chicago with the company that didn't align with our core values, or the one employee we hired because they were 3 times better than one employee, but they were an asshole and they caused us to lose 3 or 4 people that worked with that person. And so I would just say, make mistakes. It's the only way you're going to really learn, but just don't make the same mistake over and over again, because then obviously you're not learning,
Brilliant. Love it. Jared, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a super cool conversation. I love chatting with you, and I'm sure that everybody who's listening is going to take so many things away that they can go and apply to help them be an even better leader. So thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate it too. Hopefully everyone gets to borrow from these lessons as I've borrowed from others. It's that sort of pay it forward model. You don't want anybody to step in the same, you know, whatever that you did. So if you can help people avoid it, they'll find their own things to step in, but at least we can help those that maybe went down a similar journey. So thank you for having me today.
I hope you found that episode valuable, folks. And more importantly, I hope there are some practical things you can take away and do as a result of listening. What really resonated for me was this point around personal branding and managing our reputation. Whilst that might be quite a yucky concept for some of us thinking about managing our own brand and self-promotion, it is really important because if you consider that brand is really no more than what people say about us when we're not there, we've got a brand regardless of whether we're paying attention to it or not. And before you go, do remember if the section around delegation resonated with you, and that's a skill you still want to master yourself, or indeed if you've got people in your team who need to master that skill, do check out my Delegation Mastery course via the link in the show notes with that discount code POD30 that will take 30% off of the price. Feel free to share that code with any of your friends and colleagues. And as we wrap up, let me just say thank you once again for tuning in. I really do appreciate your support. And there's just one thing I'd ask for you in return. If you could just leave a review and rating for the show, wherever you happen to be listening, that would be the most helpful thing you could possibly do by way of a thank you. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, lead on.